Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome.
Hi guys, it's Tracy. And before we get to today's episode, I wanted to tell you about our holiday book drive that runs November 30th through December 14th. We are buying books for Rocket Ship Delta Prep, a school in Antioch, California, where 85% of the students live in poverty. The school doesn't have the funds to supply books to students, so many of the books that kids are reading in class are just photocopies of books stapled together. So obviously, I thought we could help. We're going to be buying books so that every single student at that school leaves on the last day of the semester with their very own book. If you want to participate, there is a link in the bio to the wish list that was put together by the teachers of Rocket Ship Delta Prep. For every book you donate, you are entered to win a prize, and we will be giving away at least one prize every single day for this 15-day book drive. Once you've given a book, you are entered to win for every single day. To be in the know about what the prizes are and how we're making progress on the book drive, make sure you're following the Stacks on social media, at the Stacks Pod on Instagram, at the Stacks Pod _ on Twitter, and the Stacks Podcast on Facebook. There are more details in the link in the show notes, so please check it all out. And I want to thank you in advance for listening to the show and participating in this book drive. Okay, now let's get to the episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast for all things bookish. I am your host, Tracy Thomas, and today I am thrilled to welcome our guest, Jason Reynolds. Jason is an author. His most recent book was a finalist for the National Book Award called Look Both Ways. You may know his work from Long Way Down, the Ghost Track series, among many others. Jason joins us today to talk about his books, his reading, his writing, and so much more. Before we get to Jason, I just wanted to do a little bit of housekeeping. All right, here it is, your weekly reminder. Everything we talk about on today's episode can be found in the show notes. There is a link there that will take you to all the books discussed today, as well as the social media accounts for The Stacks and our guests. Plus, if you shop through the links on Amazon, you're helping to keep The Stacks free. If you're looking for an amazing book recommendation, send us an email to askingthestacks@gmail.com. Myself and my guest will read it on air, discuss it, and then give you a personalized book recommendation or five. So email askingthestacks@gmail.com with your name, what you're looking for, and maybe a few titles you've loved or hated. If you like The Stacks and want to support the work we're doing, here are a few easy ways you can help. First of all, join us over on Patreon. That's a website where you support the work we're doing and earn perks for yourself. We've got a virtual book club, we got inside access to the show, and we have an amazing community of other readers who love the podcast. So head over to patreon.com/thestacks to join in. Another way to support the show is to support our sponsors like Audible. They are your go-to destination for all things audiobooks. Plus, if you listen to this show, you do get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download. So go to audibletrial.com/thestacks. The last thing you can do to help the show is definitely the easiest. Subscribe to The Stacks wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a rating and a review and tell your friends and family about the show. It goes a really long way to helping us reach new audiences. Okay, now it's time for my conversation with author Jason Reynolds. All right, you guys, I'm so excited today. I'm sitting here with author Jason Reynolds. Jason has written more books than he can even count, but the ones you probably most likely are the most like known and talked about in this moment are Long Way Down, Ghost, When I Was the Greatest, and now his newest book that came out October 2019 is called Look Both Ways, and it's already a finalist for the National Book Award. So congratulations. Welcome to The Stacks. This is so exciting for me. We're just going to start where we always start. Tell me a little bit about yourself, where you're from.
Yeah. So I'm from DC and grew up there and, just a regular neighborhood kid. You know, I have siblings and my mom raised us. My father was there for a little bit, then they split and my mom raised us. And I was raised in a really interesting household. All the things that people are doing right now, like all the things that people in our generation are doing right now for like self-care, are the things my mother's been doing for like 60 years, right? So my mom is always, she thinks it's hilarious. Like, she's like, oh, everyone's doing yoga. She's like, man, it's interesting because, you know, been doing that since I was 19 and she's 74, right? So she's like, you know, oh, look, people are meditating now. Interesting. Because I grew up in a household where meditation was in the home and My mom was, I laugh at people with quartz crystals.
Right.
Because my mother's had quartz crystals all over our house since we were young, and sage and Palo Santo and all these things that now people are using as ways to sort of create different spiritual traditions for themselves, to cleanse themselves and keep on a level. My household was that way since I was a kid. And it's interesting because I also grew up in an all black neighborhood on the East Coast. And because of the migration and the way it all works, for the most part, if you were a black person growing up on the East Coast, you was Christian or Muslim. Mm-hmm. Right. And my mom was kind of like, you know, you could just be all the things and a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And mm-hmm. it's fine. Just don't tell your friends outside of the home what happens in this house. All right. And what we're doing in this home and how, what kind of conversations we're having. So I always grew up, she raised us without any sense of shame and guilt. I don't know it. I've learned it later in life. You know what I mean? But as a kid, it was never like the word sin was never anything. Right. I never heard it in the house. Like it's so weird. Like I never heard that. And because I didn't know that, I got to live a life that was sort of led by love and not fear. And that it made me, and it still continues to make me, who I try to be, right? Who I've sort of stepped into. And look, I'm human and I have all of the things that humans have, but my mother definitely tried to give us solid ground, like truly solid ground. No sand castles, right? It sounded like, look, we're going to build you a house of brick. And in order to do that, we're going to make sure you understand who you are, what you are, how you are, why you are.
Right.
These are the ways that I grew up. And this is the kind of stuff that eventually would show itself in my work. But I wasn't a reader.
Right. I know this about you.
I wasn't a reader. Yeah.
I think it's fantastic. Well, okay. You weren't a reader, but that's not really true because you were, what were you reading?
Right. I wasn't a reader of novels.
Right. Because I feel like a lot of people say, oh, I don't read. But I'm like, you read the newspaper every day.
Exactly.
Like that's reading. And you were reading.
I was reading rap lyrics.
Yeah.
I was reading rap lyrics and I was lucky to have come up at that intersection when rap music was growing its legs.
Yeah.
You know, I remember going down to the store with my $8 and going to the music store. And for the young folks, if you're listening out there, we had music stores, like actual buildings that you had to go to. And, you know, buying my tapes. And the first tape I bought at 10 years old was Queen Latifah's Black Ring. And I just want to say as an aside, like Latifah really is underrated.
Totally.
She's a legend and she should be praised, like lifted up, you know, in the way that we lift up the Ninas and you know, Rosetta Tharpe's now and Lauryn Hill and Aretha Franklin. The way that we lift them up, we should really lift up Queen Latifah because not only was she the best one of the best rappers of that time, she also was one of the first rap moguls, definitely the first rap woman mogul. Latifah was writing her own checks. She had her own production company.
Right.
Latifah, you know, tapped into television early.
Right.
You know, living single, there is no friends without living single.
Say that one more time.
Friends does not exist, right? Because they basically realized that living single was a massive hit.
Right.
And so they tried to capitalize on it by creating a white version. That is not a conspiracy theory. That is a fact.
Right.
That is well known.
I just think people don't recognize that.
I know. And so she should get the credit for that. Like, I really believe. And then she went into jazz.
Right.
And now she's in movie production, talk shows. I mean, Latifah is Oprah Jr. and doesn't get the credit for it.
Right.
Right. She hood Oprah.
Well, right. Probably because she started
as a rapper.
That's right.
And it's a stigma.
Right.
You know, and I think that same stigma is the very thing that drove me to it.
Right.
Irreverence is attractive. You know, especially when you're young. And so that was it. I started reading rap lyrics and that introduced me to poetry. When you see lyrics from the page, you realize that it's written in the same format almost. I mean, you look at verse, chorus, right? And it looks just like any other poem that any Shakespearean poem that you read or any sort of tightly structured limerick poem that you read, it looks exactly the same. And I started to build those bridges, right? Tupac and Langston Hughes are doing the same thing. Latifah and Maya Angelou are doing the same thing, right? Slick Rick and some of Shakespeare's stuff or William Faulkner's stuff is doing the same thing. And that was eye-opening. And I decided that when I grew up, I wanted to be a poet. And I started to write poetry a lot. And I'll say that there have been moments in my life, several moments, where the stars have aligned. And this was another one of those moments. I get the Latifah tape. I'm opened up by seeing those words on the page. And then shortly after that, my grandmother passes away. Mm-hmm. And in this moment, it's the first moment that I've heard my mother cry. And anybody who remembers the first time you hear your mama cry, it's a strange, strange feeling. Mm-hmm. It's also a strange sound, right? For some reason, your mama's cries sound different than everybody else's. It's a guttural thing, only to your ears.
Right.
It's an interesting thing. And so hearing my mom cry made me want to do something to help her feel better. It's the first time I saw her broken in that way. And I wrote her this poem because I had been reading these rap lyrics, three or four lines, you know, I'm like 10. And she printed it on the funeral program without my permission. So my whole family got to read it. And everyone said, hey, man, that thing you wrote made me feel a little better. Hey, man, that thing you did. Right. And now I know, oh, there's power.
I'm gonna cry.
There's power here. Right.
Yeah.
My grandmother had 7 siblings. And in the course of 2 years, they all died. Ugh. And so everybody says, we need you to write one of those things. Oh. Right. And so the first 7 or 8 poems that I wrote were all in the deaf tradition, trying to make my family feel better. And after that, I was able to sort of figure out that this could be a thing for me.
Okay. So you're writing poems. Mm. You do that for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you still do it in some of your work.
Sure.
I mean, a lot of your work, even if it's not a poem, is rhythmic and has a, you know. But how did you decide that as someone who wasn't into books, like what was that transition from I write poems to I actually want to write a book or a narrative story? And not that poems don't have that, but like that jump to me has always been kind of like a question of, how did you, as someone who wasn't like, I love books, I grew up loving books, Roald Dahl, or, you know, like that was a part of your childhood. So how did you take, okay, I like poems, I like music, now I want this to be turned into a book?
Well, you know, first I did books of poems.
Okay.
So that was sort of the entree by myself, right? I would work my summer job and save that money and go to the printers and, you know, you put up 500, you get 1,000 books.
Right.
You flip that 1,000 books into $5,000, take another 5, right? You know, it's just like flipping the money and using books and selling books out of my backpack and out of the trunk of my mama's car, right? Like, and so I knew that books could be a thing. Books to me were collateral for the recitations, right? I would go and do recitations, and this is when spoken word was becoming a big thing.
Right.
And so I was another moment the stars aligned. Right? And I was in that world and that scene as a 15 and 16 year old sitting in the back of the club waiting for my turn to get up and do my thing and read my poems. And of course, no one was there to hear them, you know, for some of those moments. Right. But over time, that became a part of my life. And having a book was a way to walk out of there with a couple of bucks in your pocket. Right. So I understood books as product.
I see.
When I got to college, I met the stars aligned one more time, and I meet this guy named Jason, another guy named Jason, white dude, redhead, right? He's me, except on the opposite end of this, like the opposite, right? It's like looking at myself inverted, and and we become fast friends.
Okay,
he was a business major, but he was an artist.
Okay,
and so he never went to business class. He was always in the art studio, and we lived together. We were roommates. And cavalierly, he said one day we should make a book together. You write poems, I make art, we should do this thing. And, you know, you're like, all right, cool. You're my man, you're my guy. So maybe we'll do this one day. We go through these breakups, he and I, right? Our first heartbreaks.
Oh, I thought you meant of each other.
No,
had a falling out.
No. And we go through these romantic breakups. He with a woman that he had proposed to. Which was, we were in college. What was he thinking?
How dramatic.
And me with my high school sweetheart.
Okay.
Right. And we've always sort of held emotional space for one another.
Okay.
And so we start to like talk about these things like, yo, what did we do wrong? Let's talk about like, you know, we had a self-forgiveness and self-awareness and self-assessment. And so we make this book called Self. And it's this coffee table book because we're like, if we're going to do it, let's do it big.
All right.
So we like made a coffee table book and we're like, how much money is it going to cost us to make this book? He's like, all right, let me run the numbers. And we call all these printers. And there was this one printer who used to print for the Smithsonian. And they were like, oh, we could do it for you for 30 grand.
Casual.
We're 18.
Right. Just super casual numbers.
So we're like, sounds good. Right. Because back then, right? Because back then you could go and get high limit credit cards.
Right. Because what is this? Like 2000?
This is 2002.
Okay.
This is 2002. And back then you could get a Nokia phone and a high limit credit card.
Right.
By signing your name on the paper.
Perfect.
So we do that and max out the credit cards and get these books made and can't sell them.
Right.
Because in order to make any money back, we got to move them for $50 a pop.
And what 18-year-olds buying a $50 book?
It's just not happening.
I mean, 50-year-olds don't buy $50
books. Exactly. It's a beautiful book, but nobody is like, bro, we know you in real life. I'm not spending $50 to buy a book from you. Right,
right, right, right.
But after he quit school and I graduated and he's like, look, we got these books, man. We got to do something. Let's move to New York.
Amazing.
And so we moved to Brooklyn with, you know, a dollar. It's like that story, right? Dollar right. and a dream. We're running around New York City, hustling, trying to figure out how to get a book deal. Because back then, the internet wasn't nearly what it is today. All the information wasn't there.
Right.
You had to be famous. Not every business didn't have a website.
Right.
At this time. And so all we knew was rap music. And we knew that rappers used to throw demo tapes in Russell Simmons' limousine and run into Def Jam. And so we did it that way. And we're running into publishing offices and we're trying to get up the steps, trying to jump the turnstile at the security desk, trying like just wilding out, trying to get this done. And eventually, you know, long story short, my buddy who was basically feeding us every night, who had been on TV, went to high school with him, and he was successful as an actor in New York. He was like, man, I love this book. It's beautiful. I'm going to give it to my agent as a gift. And the very next day, we got a phone call. And there's a woman named Lydia Wills, who's no longer in the business at the time. She had just started to represent Aaron Magruder, who made The Boondocks, who went to school with us.
Where'd you go to school?
University of Maryland.
Oh, okay.
He started in the school newspaper. And she was representing Aaron Magruder. And she said, I don't know who you are. I don't even know what this thing you made is, but anybody willing to invest in themselves, I at least need to have a meeting with. And that's how I got in the industry.
Wow.
Came through the back door. 6 weeks later, we were signing a deal with HarperCollins. And 3 years later, the first book came out. My name is Jason Mantu. And the reason I'm telling this long story to get to the point is because it was in the process of making that book where the editor at Harper said, one of these days you're going to write novels. And I said, absolutely not. And she said, I know you want to be a poet and you are that, but you will also be a novelist. And I said, I don't even know how to write novels. I don't even have the education for it. Mm. And she said, that's where you're mistaken. Your intuition will take you farther than your education ever will. And 10 years later, working in a clothing store, which is what I was doing, what I would still be doing, by the way, if this didn't happen, a friend of mine came in the store and he said, his name was Christopher Myers. His father was the late, great Walter Dean Myers. Who was my hero, and Chris is one of my best friends. Mm. He came in the store and he said, you should try to write a story. And I said, why? He said, my father's getting older and he's not going to be able to do this forever. Walter, for those who don't know, Walter wrote the book Monster. Walter wrote The Young Landlords. If your mama's watched 227, Walter, that's what that is based on. You know, Walter was basically the James Baldwin of children's literature. And he said, my father's going to go soon. He's got to do so. Somebody got to write the stories. He said, just try to do it, but release all of the rules and all the pressures. Just do your thing, your way, your voice. Mm. And I sat at the cash register of the clothing store and in the notebook and started to scribble a story about my brother and me and being a kid. And all I could hear is that editor at Harper who said, it's your intuition, trust your gut.
Mm.
Did it my way, my voice, and life changed forever.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so awesome. I want to shift slightly to kids. Because you spend a lot of time with kids. You write for kids, young people. I don't know. Are they called kids when they're like 15, teenagers?
They're young people.
Young folks. You write for young folks. I want to know, because I'm not around young people a lot. And I think most people aren't. Even people who have kids aren't, except for their own kids. And even then, it's not that many hours a day when you really look at it. Like a lot of it's sleep time, right? So my question is kind of, what have you seen in kids as they see your work? Like, are you revolutionary to them in the way that you might be to someone of an older generation, like a young Black man who's writing stories about Black and brown kids who are going through these things? Or are you do they feel like, of course, this is what should be in a book?
Mm. No, they know that it's different. Yeah, they know. And they, because for many of them, it's the first time that they've been able to get through a book. Right. So this is, you know, thousands of 17-year-olds' first books. Right. This is me. This is me talking to me again. This is me providing me with a book that I needed when I was their age. And they make it very clear. You know, I meet kids all over the world who say, hey man, I just wanted to say this is the first, this is it. This is the first thing I've read. I'm 17 and a half, I'm 18, I'm 19.
Right.
I'm 14, whatever it is. And they're like, I hated reading, but now I think I'm going to like it more, or if I can read more of your books. Or, you know, teachers all over the country shifting curriculum, right, to make sure that the young people are getting what they need using this work and this literature, because it can be used. I work very hard to make sure that it's entertaining, but also that it's sophisticated. This is This is literature that has merit. You know, that means something to me. The language, the lines, the themes, the motifs, all the secret metaphors and layers to the stories. I wanted to feel easy at 14 and then reread again at 18. It's a different book.
Right.
Right. And again at 25 and it's a different book. And so I've been fortunate to have so many young folks say like, this is it.
Okay.
This is it. If you go to Barnes and Noble, there's a section that just says Jason Reynolds. Because, and not because of me, but because of what they come in there and saying like, yo, this is what we want.
Right.
Where are these books?
Okay. So what does... So you said you write for you, adult you writes for a younger version of you. Mm-hmm. What does younger version of you say to adult you? What's the advice that 15-year-old Jason gives to you now?
Hang on to me. Mm-hmm. Hang on to me. People ask, you know, the question that adults get, the other sort of framing of that question is like, what would you tell 15-year-old?
Yeah, but I feel like everyone gets that. Like, what have you learned in your life? But what's the thing that the young you...
Hang on.
Yeah.
Because the truth of the matter is that there's, if the younger version of myself got it right.
Right.
The younger version got it right. The younger version understood we could do all the things, right? The younger version understood, you know, the world is malleable.
Mm. Well, and the younger version of you is jumping turnstiles to give a $50 book.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Like there's an optimism and a courage, and sort of a, you know, like I had no caution. There was no caution to anything. I was kind of like, look, I'm gonna do my thing because I believe that my thing is a value. Right. There's an ego to a 16-year-old that we downplay and dismiss. But really, it's like, no, hang on to that little bit. Life will do everything it can to chip it away. Don't worry. It'll settle. Right. But you got to hang on to that. And if when you get older, you know, one of the gifts you learn is that there's a difference between being irreverent and being irresponsible.
Sure.
But that irreverence is something that we have to cherish.
And it's a fine line.
It is.
It's a fine line.
It is.
If you're doing it right, you probably
have crossed the line.
Bucked up a little bit on one side or the other.
Listen, I am the king of it. At 35, there are more irresponsible moments than I should probably be having. But sure. It is what it is.
Yeah. You know, but that's human nature too.
You got to have a story to tell.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to talk more about Look Both Ways probably next week when we talk about Jacqueline Whitton, and because the works are connected in a lot of ways. But one of the things I do want to just touch on about Look Both Ways is that we should kind of say what it's about, I guess, a little bit. It's a story about kids who walk home from school. It's told in 10 chunks, 10 sections. They're kind of their own short stories, but it also functions as a whole, which is really cool because I think that's great for young readers who it is the beginning of their reading life and they get bored and, you know, anyways. But one of the things that really stuck out to me about this book and the way that you told this story is that all of the kids have some sort of trauma or something that they're going through, but they are not their trauma.
Mm.
And I think that that's really powerful. And one of the observations that I had reading the book was Jason Reynolds is really observant. Mm. Like, I feel like there's something about you where you see people, you can see that, and you can also see other things. Mm. I think a lot of people, myself, I can speak for myself. If I know someone has had, you know, their dad died when they were 7, or they are, you know, they have foster parents or whatever, that's what I think of first. And I feel like in this book, you found a way to make these kids really whole. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's something that you consciously think of, or if that's just because these are the kids that you know and you grew up with, or if it's some combination, but kind of like, how did you decide these kids and these stories and still make them feel both rooted and heavy and also just fun? They're so great.
I think that's a conscious decision. I work really hard to ensure that who I'm trying to portray is portrayed with some balance and some wholeness and some humanity.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if you're around kids enough, you realize that they're all coping.
Mm-hmm.
And they always make time for laughter No matter what kind of weight they have on their back, nothing sort of overtakes the necessity to roast each other.
Right.
I just saw a picture recently of somebody posted or sent me, I can't remember, of Syrian kids who are trying to get to a place of refuge. And the photograph is of them. My friend Daniel. And the photograph of them is all of them laughing and joking. Once the camera came out, it was just like, it was time to put on and laugh. It was showtime, right? Yeah. Even though these are young people with nothing, who are walking to freedom and who may not all make it there.
Right.
In this moment, there's laughter. There's joy. And so we are not our traumas. You know, Alice Walker says, you know, we carry our wounds and our medicines as we go. Both. Mm-hmm. We carry both of those things. And we can't have one without the other. We focus so much on our wounds, but we also possess our medicines. And young people are no different. They have our medicine. They have their medicines.
Right.
As well as their wounds. And I want to make sure that I'm doing my job as the observer. Like, I'm not a kid.
Right.
I'm riding outside of my lane. Right. I mean, I was a kid, right? But I'm not, the world is different. And they're living different lives. Sure, the big things are similar, but the details are very, very different.
Right.
There's even like a little Easter egg. There's a lot of Easter eggs in this book. But there's one, since you said, you're like the observer. So there's the story, the title story, which is Look Both Ways. And, you know, the young girl, she trips up and she falls and hurts herself on the way home. And the school bus is coming by and all the kids are laughing. And she says, I look up and I see this one kid with a lisp and he's you know, you're going to kill yourself. You know, whatever he says.
Yeah.
And then she says, but there's a kid behind him, a little dark skinned boy with dreadlocks sticking from the top of his head, holding a notebook up to his face. And I can't see his mouth, but I know he's not laughing. It's me. That I wrote me into the book, you know, as the observer,
right,
as the person with the notebook, observing, not laughing or judging or making them feel small, just observing.
Are you that person, like with your friends and stuff?
I am.
You're like the observer. You've always been.
I've always sort of looked at the nuances of our lives. You know, I'm always the guy who is like, "What's the matter?" Right. And your friend says, "You know, it's this, that, and the third." And then I say, "So, like, what's the matter?
Mm.
Like, what's going on?"
Right.
You know what I mean? Because I know how I operate and how I move.
Right.
You know what I mean? And sometimes you got to ask the question more than once to get to the root of a thing. Let a person know that it's okay, that you're opening them up for a space of humility and that they're safe. Right. So, that's how I'm built, you know, for better or for worse. Being an empath is also terrible.
Right. Well, everything is like that. Everything that's good about us can also be...
Our wounds and our medicines.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. Okay. We're going to transition a little. I have other questions for you that I'm going to like try to squeeze in because I have a lot of questions. we'll get there. So we do this thing called Ask the Stacks where someone has written in, they want a book recommendation. I think this is going to be good for you. It's totally different than what you write. So I'm excited. This person is named Kira B. She says, my name is Kira, and I moved from Boston to Denver almost 2 years ago. I love memoir, nonfiction, travel books, literary fiction, historical fiction, and the classics. However, I have noticed a huge gap in my reading, history. I somehow got away with not taking any history courses throughout college and beyond, so I would like readable, engrossing history books that will fill my knowledge gap of American and world history. And then some of the books she says that she loves are Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson, Educated by Tara Westover, The Island of Sea Women by Lisa C., and then a book that she did not like was Lincoln and the Bardo by George Saunders. So Kira, this is definitely my wheelhouse. I love a history. I have a few here for you. The one that I would say of all of the books about history that I've ever read that has been the most meaningful for me was The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson.
Absolutely.
That book is about the migration of Black folks from the South to the North and the West. And it tells a history of America in a way that as a Black woman, I'd never understood. And my father was part of the Great Migration. He came from Louisiana in the 30s to California in the 30s to California, which is actually one of the characters in the story's journey. And it's just really powerful and moving. And it makes sense of a lot of the reasons America is the way that it is, not just for Black folks, but for everybody and the landscape and how Chicago got to be Chicago and how, you know, we have Black folks in Portland, Oregon. Like, why is that a thing? How did that happen? So that book talks a lot about that, and it's amazing. Another history that I love is Blood in the Water by Heather Ann Thompson about the Attica prison uprising. This is a super small moment. It's 9 days in September 1971, but she really, I mean, the book won a Pulitzer, so I'm not saying anything that no one else has said about the book, but it's phenomenal. Heather Ann Thompson is, she did a lot of work, you could tell. I mean, same with Isabel Wilkerson. And then the last one that I would say, which is kind of totally different. I read this book this year when I went to Japan. It's called Hiroshima Nagasaki, and it's by Paul Hamm, and it's all about the atomic bombing. And what's really interesting about the book is that it questions Truman and America in a way that I've never seen, and it questions the, did we really need to drop those bombs? And it talks about the science and it talks about the history, but it also puts a lot of focus on America and Japan in World War II, which we never really see. And that way, it's so much about Germany. It's so much about Europe. And this book is almost exclusively about Japan and not just, you know, America's role, but also what it did to the Japanese and who they are. So if you're looking for something a little more world history, that kind of combines the two. I have a list of more, but those are the ones I'll say. All right, your turn, Jason.
Oof, this is a tough one. It's a good one, though.
I left one for you.
You did, okay. Obviously. I'm like, okay. She threw me the alley-oop. Yeah. So, of course, I'm going to say Stamp from the Beginning, which to me might very well be the most important book about race that we've had in the 21st century. It's just definitive. And he, first of all, he doesn't necessarily call it definitive. It you know, publishing is interesting, but it is a really wide swath of racial and race history, starting from the 1400s, Portugal, and ending all the way at, you know, Black Lives Matter and right. What, just a couple of years ago. It's pretty brilliant and extensive.
And it's a hard read and just work through it.
A little bit at a time. You know, a little bit. And it's broken in. And just to give you some more context, it's broken into five sections that cover five people that he uses as the pillars of that time to talk about race. So he has Cotton Mather, and Cotton Mather is basically the grandson of the Puritan founders of this country. He has Thomas Jefferson, who we all know, right? He has William Lloyd Garrison when it comes to sort of abolitionism and working through media, right? Race media, liberation media, and all that kind of stuff. He has W.B. Du Bois to talk about you know, what it meant to be sort of upwardly mobile and black and free, and what that actually meant, and what and if freedom was actually a thing, or were we all living in the avatars of freedom, and the complications and the complexities that are wound into all that is pretty brilliant. And then the great Angela Davis, who he argues is basically the quintessential anti-racist and who we should all be studying to understand how to break the chains. Because she sits at the intersection of all the things, whether it be race, class, sexuality, gender, like every education,
right?
Like she literally sits right at the intersection of all the things and has never made a mistake. So she has not misstepped. She has not slipped into assimilationism or racism ever that we have documented.
Right.
And so he's using her as sort of the pillar. Shout out to Angela Davis.
Yeah,
we should all be so lucky to have her still with us. And so that book is definitely a recommendation. I would also say read Angela Davis. She has so much work that gives so much history around this country, specifically as it pertains to racial politics. A slight change of pace would be, I think it's called Best Hard Time.
I don't know that.
Timothy Egan.
Okay.
It's about the Dust Bowl.
Okay.
It's a masterpiece.
Okay.
He won some huge award, maybe the National Book Award, I think, 4 years ago, but it's narrative nonfiction, so it reads like a novel. It's a masterpiece, and it explains the middle of the country.
Okay.
Right? And so what he does is he basically just spells out how the Dust Bowl even happened and how it was all sort of governmental hoax, right? It's convincing people that there was land that could be farmed, knowing that it couldn't be farmed. Right. And over time, that land was picked up and picked up and picked up until nothing was left of it, but dry land and dust, right? But the settlements that happened in the Dust Bowl and in that book explains the heartland as it pertains today. And it's important that we do the necessary research to understand and to humanize and connect with with the people who live in the middle of our country because they're human beings and they're Americans. Enough with the flyover nonsense. Like, stop saying that.
Right.
Right. It's derogatory and disrespectful.
Right.
There are humans there.
Right.
And those humans who live there have a history.
Do you get there often?
I just spent a ton of time in small towns. I just left a small town in Kansas last week. Before that, I was in Seward, Nebraska. I've been all through Illinois, the parts outside of Chicago, Bone Gap and Olney and La Crosse, Wisconsin. And I spent a lot of time in small towns because I don't just love the children in New York and in L.A.
Right.
And in D.C., right? And there are children in Arkansas.
Right.
And the political bullshit that we all sort of volley back and forth has nothing to do with them.
Right. And I also argue that some of that political media talking point stuff is not even real. Like, so much of it is like the idea that, you know, I am someone who lived in California, New York, so I'm obviously going to be defensive of the coast. Sure. But one of the things that always has irritated me is this idea that people on the left are in any more of a bubble than people anywhere else.
Exactly.
It's like I interact with just as many diverse people, you know, and I understand that it's like, oh, political beliefs are different, but I'm in no more of a bubble here in LA than I was, you know, than when I lived in Colorado for a little bit, than those people were. And I think that the idea that some bubbles are bad is just, it's harmful.
And also
it's in the way.
And also we get to talk about, we talk about people from periphery.
Right.
And I think that's dangerous.
Right.
I think it's a lot harder to be as judgmental and as hateful for all of us, right? Whether you're in whatever conservative bubble, quote unquote liberal bubble or progressive bubble. The truth of the matter is that if we're not standing face to face, it's really easy to be hateful and harmful.
Right.
But once you're standing face to face with a person and you're having actual discourse, it becomes a lot difficult to not complicate your argument, which is important for us all, to always be complicating our arguments and not making it easy for ourselves to be judgmental and hateful. And so that book, I think, is just a brilliant, it's really something.
Okay. That's awesome. Okay, Kira, those are your books that we have for you. There's only 100 billion more. So if you need more, just, you know, slide in my DMs. Okay. Yay. We're going to talk about your books now. I'm so excited. Two books you love, one book you hate.
Two books I love, one book I hate. I know I was supposed to prepare for this.
It's okay.
But the two books I love, one is Jesmyn Ward's Salvage the Bones. For me, it's a perfect book.
I've never read it.
Ooh.
My favorite is Men We Reaped.
Oh, it's my least favorite.
Really?
Yeah.
I love nonfiction.
Got you.
Yeah. I'm a nonfiction queen.
If you read Salvage the Bones.
I have it. I own it.
It's really a masterpiece.
Okay.
Really a masterpiece. My second book, should I give context about Salvage the Bones? Just a quick.
You can.
Salvage the Bones is basically about I believe she's 15-year-old girl named Esh. This is DeLille, Mississippi. And she doesn't have a mother, but she has brothers and a father and a pit bull. And this is 12 days leading up to Hurricane Katrina. And so this is the storm before the storm, basically. And what her expectations are, what's going on with her and her family in this small town. It is brilliant. Brilliant to read about the Black American South. So it's, okay. Another book that I love. Oh, God, so many. I really loved recently Colson Whitehead's Nickel Boys.
So
yo.
Good.
So good.
Is he kidding?
I couldn't believe it. And I'm slow on, like, you know, it's a lot of gas around Colson. It always has been for a very long time. So I was like, all right, we'll see. I mean, I read everything that he's written, but I'm like, all right, let's see. And then I read Nickel Boys and I'm like, oh yeah, he's the real deal.
Yes.
He's the real deal.
I refer to people like him as professional writers.
Yeah.
Also, I heard him talking about the book and he said that he wanted it to be 200 pages and it's like 212 and he was disappointed in himself.
Yeah.
It's like, it's maybe the most perfect 212 pages.
It might be.
It's a whole story.
It's unreal.
It's unreal.
It's unreal. And what he does at the end is unnecessary and still perfect.
Perfect.
He could have just ended it.
Yeah.
And we're like, this is amazing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and instead, he does another thing.
So good.
He pulls rabbit out of the hat.
I really liked Underground Railroad. I thought that was a really good book. Again, I'm not a fiction person. So when I say that I like something that's fiction, for normal people, you probably think it's a great book, but I'm very hard on fiction.
Gotcha.
And I really liked Underground Railroad and I was excited about Nickel Boys. And I finished Nickel Boys and was like,
yeah.
How rude.
And I was kind of like, on Underground. Cause yeah. I felt I was on Homegoing. Like, so that was the year.
Oh,
that
I was out on Homegoing.
See? And so Homegoing was out the same year. Mm. And he swept her and Yajiyasi. And I was on the Ya bandwagon. I was like, this is the book.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I was out on Homegoing. Yeah. I thought Homegoing got too much hype and love.
See?
Is Homegoing a YA book?
No.
Okay, because some people have told me that it is. And then I was like, oh, maybe it is.
No.
Okay.
This is capital L literature.
I mean, not that why it can't be. I just wasn't sure if the audience was like supposed to be younger.
Nah.
No. Okay. Nah. What about a book you hate?
Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Oh, why?
I thought he left too much up to the reader's imagination when it came to the protagonist. I thought that the voice of the protagonist was off, and it was so far off that it made you wonder if the young person had Asperger's, but he never says that it's Asperger's. And so it just reads like, and you can't suggest it's Asperger's.
Right.
You can't it's inappropriate to suggest Asperger's and he doesn't say it's Asperger's. And so because he doesn't say it's Asperger's, the voice just feels robotic and static and strange and off, in a way that I just found to be dissonant and whack, to be honest. I didn't get the hype. I was like, I'm good on this.
Okay. What are you reading right now?
Ta-Nehisi's book, The Water Dancer.
How's it going?
It's going all right. Like, I got a lot of respect for Cuz. I think he is who he is. He the man.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I got, no disrespect to him. I'm interested to see how he does as a fiction writer.
I'm so interested.
And the language is beautiful. If I were to critique anything, because I think the story so far is fire, right? I'm like, oh, this is really interesting. I was a little nervous because it's like it's a slave narrative. I was like, do we really need to do this again?
Right.
But I think it's really cool. He's doing some magic stuff. Like, it's really interesting. If I had to critique him, I'm sure he listens to this, and that's fine.
That would be my dream.
I'm sure he does.
Also, can you come on the podcast? Your people are giving me a hard time.
I'm sure he listens to this. And I get a message, and he's like, that's messed up, bro. Like, who are you? But, it feels a tiny bit overwritten. Just the language feels a little overwritten. And sometimes people love that.
Right.
I just have my taste. For me, it's like I like it to be. I think there's power in brevity when it comes to writing. I think there's power in, like Chimamanda said years ago, there's nothing better than a short, lucid sentence.
Mm-hmm.
I think we forget that, like, it takes skill.
Right.
To show constraint.
Well, that's Nickel Boys. Right? Like, that is like a perfectly edited piece. It's so good. What are some books that are coming out maybe soon or that you haven't quite gotten to that you're looking forward to?
I want to read Edwige's collection of short stories, Edwige Danticat's new collection of short stories. I have it. I just haven't read it yet.
Okay.
I also just got... I'm trying to read more like translated works.
Yeah.
I think we struggle in America. It's only here, by the way, that where we don't read like a lot of translated works.
Right.
And I think we should. Olga, I can never pronounce her last name, but Olga just won
the Nobel.
Just
casual.
Hey, man. I kind of figured that she would. And so I'm picking through her new joint. I'm always waiting to see what Ali Smith is doing. She's one of my biggest influences. You know, there's a lot of Ali Smith in that book, as a matter of fact.
Look Both Ways.
Yeah, like in terms of style. I think she's one of the most courageous writers of our time.
I don't think I know who that is.
She wrote Autumn, Spring, Winter.
Okay.
Those books.
Okay.
And she's written, it's a lot of books. She's basically she's the European, to me, and this is blasphemy, but she's what Toni Morrison is to so many of us over here. To me, Ali Smith, in terms of courage and just pushing the line.
Okay.
And doing whatever she wants to do on the page. Ali Smith is that over in the UK. She's brilliant and a good buddy of mine. And I feel when I met her years ago and I told her how underrated I thought she was in America. And I was grateful that she took so many risks. She said, you and I would be friends because you understand that the secret to literature is that the risk is all.
Yeah.
Right. And there's that. And she just, she's everything.
Okay. Yeah. I have to check her out. What's a book that you like to recommend to people?
Salvage the Bones. I probably recommend that book more than anything else. You know what else, though? anything written by Kiese Layman. And people, I know Heavy is like his breakout, but the truth is, How to Kill Yourself or Others Slowly in America and Long Division are masterful pieces of literature that many people haven't read. Long Division is a feat. It's so hard to do what he did in that book with time travel and, you know, racial commentary and regional commentary and educational commentary. I mean, it's just really, and then he's jumping from the 80s to the current day to the 60s. I mean, it's a masterpiece, masterpiese. So shout out to Kiese. I recommend that an awful lot as well. And what's one last book that I'm always thinking about? I don't know. There's just, do yourself a favor and read Langston Hughes' Simple Stories. You know what I mean? If you want to see a short story.
Right.
You know, or read Jamaica Kincaid's Girl. Mm. Right. Like, and that's who's also a big influence in Look Both Ways.
Okay.
Right. Because the whole thing is just a string of like, you know, almost like a stream of consciousness.
Right.
It's beautiful.
Okay. What's a book that someone has recommended to you that you thought was like great recommendation?
Probably A Kweke Emezi's Pet. That one. I think it's been a lot. I hate everything.
Me too.
Yeah. Like I have a super high bar.
I feel like I've said so many books I like today, but I hate every book.
I have a super high bar.
Okay.
Right. And in every category.
Right.
And that book felt fresh and bold. And to write something speculative, something gender nonconforming, three parents, and it doesn't feel trite and overtried and hackneyed. It doesn't feel checkboxed. Right? It doesn't feel tokenized. It's just like, no, like
this is the world.
This is the world.
Right.
And the idea that the monsters only return if you forget.
Right. How much reading do you do?
A lot of reading.
Like, what does that mean? Like, how many books would you say you read in a month or so?
Like 4 or 5, probably. Okay. I mean, I try to read an hour a day.
Okay.
Thanks, Lisa Lucas. That was her. She's like, just read an hour a day, and then you'll be able to like really get some stuff done. And so, I try to set aside an hour. I'm pulling books off the shelves, and because I work in this industry, they mail me. I have everything.
Everything comes.
Everyone just sends me books because they hope that I like it enough to blurb it. And so I just happen to have everything in ARC form at the house, you know.
Right. It's one of the joys of working in the book world, at least for me as a reader. I don't write, so I don't have the pressure of I need to do my own writing. Like that time for me for work is, you know, working on the podcast. But getting books. I never thought it would ever happen. I never thought it was even a thing. So now when I get books, I still, a year and a half into this show, I'm like, oh my God, someone sent me their book. Like, it just, I like to read.
It's so good, right?
it feels nice. Do you set goals for yourself around reading?
No.
No.
No, I have too many goals for myself around writing. I can't do much more, right? I don't have the mental capacity. And I have just terrible anxiety. It's just too much. You know what I mean? Like it has to feel like a thing that I'm doing because I want to do it.
So you'll set a book down if you're not into it.
Oh, it got 20, 30 pages and I'm out of there. You better make something happen. I need something to happen.
Early.
Or the language got to be jumping. You know what I mean? If it's not, I don't have time for this. And people will be like, have you read it? Man, I ain't.
Yeah.
You know, you got to get back to it. I'm good, man.
Right.
Tell me what it's about.
Yeah.
Like I'm good. I don't have. Life too short. No.
Okay. This is a question that I have just recently thought about, and I just started adding it into the Short Stacks episodes, but I've not added it yet here. What's a word that you spell wrong always?
Restaurant.
Restaurant.
Always.
Okay.
The A-U, because it's the A and then it's the A-U, or is it the A-U and then the A? I always get it wrong.
Now I don't know how to spell it.
See?
I'm a terrible speller, but I've become obsessed with this idea because we all have the word. And for a long time, I just thought I was an idiot. Like I thought recommendation was, you know, like you would get a PhD if you could spell it correctly. And then I realized other people have the word.
Yeah. Restaurant. Every time.
And the red line comes up and I'm like, I know. Just, can you just learn me better? Are you a computer?
I don't know.
Like I don't do, recommend has never happened. Recommendation has never happened. Recommender. And I say it all the time because I recommend books all the time.
Right.
And I'm always trying to like type it up. Like I hate you. Okay. I think I know the answer, but I'm curious. You're a rereader, right? You'll reread a book. Mm-hmm. What are some of the books that you make a point to reread?
Oh, that's a good one. So Salvage the Bones. Brown Girl Dreaming, The Fire Next Time, The Autobiography of Malcolm X. The Autobiography of Malcolm X is one of the greatest books ever. That's a history book. You should have put
I put down Malcolm X, Manning Marable's version.
Okay.
Also
okay.
amazing.
Absolutely.
Both are amazing.
Oh my God. Yes.
He's unreal.
Shout out to Malcolm X.
Yeah.
So I reread that book all the time. Mm. What else? I mean, I love The Color Purple.
Okay.
I think it was sort of, it broke the mold for the epistolary novel. I love, Montage of a Dream Deferred, Langston Hughes' collection. It's one of my prized possessions. I own a copy. There's only a few copies that exist in the world. And I own the actual book. We all know pieces from the book, right? Mm-hmm. But I have the book, and so I read it often, and it is a masterpiece. And it did not sell when he was alive. It was not a hit, even though it was his best work ever. It did not do what he thought it would do.
Interesting.
Montage of a Dream Deferred. Gene Toomer's Cain.
I don't know that.
Gene Toomer's Cain. So Cain was written, I believe this is the 1940s. It might have been 1920s. It's written by Gene Toomer, who's a black man, and it's got all the forms in it. So like it's poems, it's little short vignettes, it's you know, long form prose, it's a telling of the story of this. It's really, I can't even explain it. It's one of those books that like you just have to know it. You have to read it. And it's hard.
Okay.
Right. But it's also so when you put it in context to the time, it's by far one of the most creative things and the most bold pieces of literature given the context of when it was written.
Right.
Brilliant. Gene Toomer's Cain.
Cain. Okay.
Yeah. So
what's the last book that made you laugh?
It's such a tough question because books be mad heavy these days, I feel like.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
I never read books that make me laugh. Though, Look Both Ways, I did laugh.
There's some funny. But I can't say my own book.
No, you can't.
Like, yeah, I'm not
I can say it, but you can.
Thank you. Skip.
Okay, we'll skip.
I don't know.
Okay, what's the last book that made you cry?
Oh, God. That's an easy one. I mean, there's so many books that make me cry. Probably Nickel Boys.
Mm.
I mean, that scene when they talk about, you know, what it means to go out back or whatever it was, the murdering of children.
Mm-hmm.
I can't. That's a lot for me.
Yeah. It's a lot, I think, for most people.
I hope so.
I feel like most people are like, that's super cash. No, no biggie. What about a book that made you angry?
Honestly, so I had to read Stamped like 10 times, right?
Right.
Cover to cover.
Tell them why.
Because I had to adapt it. I adapted it into a young reader's version. And we're calling it a young reader's version, but really it's just a more colloquial version for the everyday person, you know. And that book really, it really maddened me. It angered me because what I thought I knew was only the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
And so suddenly you start getting into the SAT and you start getting into IQ tests. And you start getting into the movies you grew up watching, like Rocky and Planet of the Apes. And you start, right, and everything becomes contextualized. And suddenly it's like a veil has been lifted. And you realize your entire life has been a really perverse negotiation with whiteness.
Right.
It's painful.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's painful.
The book is super eye-opening for me as a black woman. And I do want, sometimes I wonder if the experiences that I have, how other people who identify different ways have, like with a book like that, like I'd be so curious, you know, what a white 60-year-old man's reaction to Stamped would be, or, you know, like a Filipino 25-year-old woman, because there's so much in that book and there's not in a bad way, but it's a lot of finger pointing. Like it's a lot of this led to this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I said that not in a bad way because it's not saying like white people are bad, but it is saying like this thing happened and these are the people who made this happen. And it was very upsetting to me.
Yeah.
And so I actually read that book very quickly because I just wanted to get through it.
It's a lot. I mean, even from the very beginning, thinking about like from the beginning of the country and this idea, and everybody knows like, oh, well, America's built on slavery. Yes. But there's also this thing about like, well, if the Puritans come here and they believe that the greatest thinker of the world is Aristotle, who was a terrible sort of, you know, person, and he believed in human hierarchy. And he believed that the Greeks were superior, and then the non-Greeks, and then the Puritans say, well, we can take what he did and change it to Puritanism. And then when we start our first university, which would be Harvard University, what we'll do is we'll say that everything can be challenged except for Greek and Latin literature. Mm. And therefore, Aristotle can never be challenged. And so the theory of human hierarchy becomes etched in stone, right? So not only is it religion, it's also education from the beginning.
Right.
Right. Racist from the beginning.
Right.
And it's, that is painful.
Yeah. And it, if you start talking about it too long, you get really start to get worked up. Okay. Which is why the next question is, what's a book that brings you joy?
Honey, I Love by Eloise Greenfield.
I think who that, you dedicated
who
your
I dedicated
book to.
This book to. Eloise Greenfield, for those who don't know, she used to be the Poet Laureate of Washington, D.C., but she also is this wonderful children's writer. She's 95 years old now, still working. And she wrote a book called Honey, I Love. And I would encourage everyone to go get it. They have the pocket version, which costs like $2. I've gifted this to every kid I've known. I mean, over the years, my godchildren, my nieces and nephews, adults, right? It's it is a masterpiece, and it's beautiful. And it's these little illustrations and little poems. Just love poems about or for or from children. And it's just, that's the one.
Okay. What about a book where you felt like you learned a lot?
So I could cheat, right, and say it's Stamped. But honestly, I have to say The New Jim Crow.
Oh, so good.
Opened me up. Changed a lot. The New Jim Crow really was something because it helped me really understand and contextualize the new conversation that was going to come. It really is the book to me that was the beginning of what we now have and this new sort of nuanced discussion around the racial structures and whiteness and the Constitution and prison. And I think, you know, shout out to Michelle Alexander. I think it's massively done.
Yeah. Okay. So last night I went and I saw you talking to LeVar Burton at Barnes & Noble here in LA. And you talked about your day and your routine where you wake up and you write for a few hours and then more than a few, like a 9 to 5, 7 to 2, 7 to 2, you said. And then you said you go to the movies almost every day. Mm. So what is the book that you would like to see turned into a movie?
Mine or someone else's? Anyone's?
Well, let's say not yours.
Okay, perfect.
Though Look Both Ways and Long Way Down would be great movies.
Well,
I think children's or like young people's books are inherently more cinematic, more because you got to get that story out.
Those books are gone. They're already the movie thing is happening.
Yeah, so that's fantastic.
But that wasn't what I would pick. Okay. But I won't pick my own book.
Don't pick your own book.
I won't pick. What have I read? The Nickel Boys.
Yeah. Yo.
That would be a movie.
Oh my God. Who would you cast? I probably don't even know any actors quite young enough.
I love that kid. Shameik Moore.
Which one is he?
He did the Spider-Man voice in the Spider-Verse. He did Dope, the movie Dope.
Oh, okay,
that kid.
Okay.
I love that kid.
Yeah.
I love that. You know who else? Have you ever seen Meet Earl and the Dying Girl?
No, but I've heard of it.
The black kid, Earl, in that movie, wherever he is.
Well, that movie's, he's probably too old now.
Right? Nah, he's probably like 16.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that kid, a genius. Like, I'd love to see him too. I don't know, but it's...
Yeah,
that movie.
That would make a good movie. All right. I always skip over this question, but I'm going to do it with you. I think about what questions I want to do with people, and I'm, for whatever reason, I'm very curious.
Okay.
You can't say yourself.
I won't.
Okay. Who would you like to write the story of your life? So like you can write your own story. It can be like the autobiography of Jason Reynolds, but who is the Manning Marable that's going to tell your story? Or who's the person that you would want to tell your story that's not you?
Kiese Layman.
Okay.
And the reason why is because if anyone's ever met Kiese Layman, what you know about him is one, he's 1,000% himself all the time. And two, he is in a massive love affair with black people.
Okay.
His life is a love affair with black people. And that matters to me because I know that he'd write me with love. He'd write me with thoughtfulness. He'd take care of me, right? And he'd tell the truth.
Right.
He'd tell the truth, but he would tell the truth and simultaneously take care of my legacy of who I am and what I've done and what I wanted to do, what my intentions were, despite my shortcomings, which there are gazillions.
Sure.
You know, he would put them all in there and tell the truth about who I really was. But he'd also make sure that it was all couched in an overwhelming amount of love.
All right. That's good. So I almost always ask, what's a book you're embarrassed that you've never read? But I'm
easy.
Okay, go.
Harry Potter.
Oh, me neither. Never. But you're embarrassed?
I work in children's literature.
I guess that's true. I'm like truly like proud of it. I'm like, yeah, I've never read Harry Potter. What's it to you? But I guess that's true. Okay. What's a book that you're proud to have read?
That's a good question.
It's sometimes harder.
It is. What's a book that I'm proud to have read? Beloved. Because people really be fronting like they read it. And I just know that people have not read it.
I only read it because we did it on the show.
The thing is that I think it's one of the books that it's one of the most lied about, but people lie about having read it because it's just one of those social zeitgeist things where it's like, have you read Beloved? You know, and it's like, it's okay if you haven't read it, but I am proud that I read it. Now, do I think it requires a second and third and fourth reading? Yes. Yes. I think it's a book you grow into.
Yeah.
Right. But I'm proud to have gotten through it.
Yeah.
I mean, have stuck it out for sure.
Yeah. That's a good one. That's a good one. Oh, I have to ask you this. What's the book you would assign in school? Let's say high school, if you're a teacher.
Definitely. And it's been assigned. People are assigning it. The Autobiography of Malcolm X.
Sure.
I really think it's just.
It's not really, though.
Yeah, you don't think it's being assigned?
It was assigned, but I took an African-American history class in high school. That wasn't regular. It was like an elective.
Yeah, I think it should be assigned.
And I didn't read it in high school.
It should be a school-wide read.
Yeah, I didn't even read it in high school. I was like, no. And then I read it when I was 22 and was like, this is the greatest thing I've ever read.
Same. I read it when I was older. And I was like, what? This is the best because of literature.
Okay, I'm so glad you're here. Okay. We talk about this a lot. What book would you assign in school? People pick books that often are things like The Autobiography of Malcolm X or some other book that is like a major work that is talking about a major person, often to do with race, or sometimes it has to do with consent or those types of things. But you go to school and you see teachers who are teaching these books. Mm. In the wrong hands, what happens to The Autobiography of Malcolm X?
In the wrong hands.
Or just in like, not even a teacher who is deeply racist or something, but just a teacher who doesn't get it.
Yeah. It's bastardized, right? It's ruined, right? And so that's the danger of it all.
Right.
And so like, but I think that's every book.
Sure.
I don't think that there's any book that I would put in the hands that I would want to be taught in school by a teacher who wasn't equipped to teach it.
Right.
Right. Like that's just like Shakespeare. Shakespeare's brilliant.
Ugh, my fave.
But he's ruined in school.
Ruined.
Because they don't have the time. Some of them have some of them are equipped and do have the knowledge and the information to really teach it, but they don't have the time that it takes to really get into the layers and the levels and the brilliance of a lot of that work. But so you grow up hating Shakespeare.
Well, yeah, I was a theater major, so I had a drama teacher. We read it out loud, and that is basically the key.
It was meant to be seen anyway.
It was meant to be seen and heard.
Yeah.
And so that's half the battle.
Exactly.
But I just, because it's like, how do you get teachers to teach things right? You can't expect them to teach everything right because they come from their own place and their own things, and that just might not be.
Yeah, but I think you got to get teachers. Look, at the end of the day, I choose Malcolm X, but the truth is that I just want teachers. I wish that more teachers could just teach the things they love.
Right.
Right. Because then it all works.
Right.
Right. Just teach the things that you love.
Right.
Because at least even if you're teaching a race blind curriculum, at least you've engaged young people with reading and writing and loving,
and they can go read the things.
And get it exactly.
Totally.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I've asked that question a lot and I always love the answers, but then sometimes I think and I'm like, I'm so glad my English teacher did not try to teach that.
Facts.
Cause I have an English teacher, I won't say her name, but she was great. And she taught Romeo and Juliet. She actually did a great job, but she could not have taught The Autobiography of Malcolm X. No, there's not a chance in the world.
Yeah, I don't. That's true.
Okay, last one. My favorite. Well, one of my favorites. Stole it from the New York Times. If you could require the President of the United States of America, the current one, to read one book, what would it be?
That is a doozy. And I listen to this podcast so much. I know this question is coming, right? I listen to this every week. To this podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
What would I have the President of the United States read? Are we sure the president of the United States can read?
So part of this question is you have to suspend your disbelief. You okay. have to assume that he could read it or he would audiobook it. And you have to assume that he would understand the content enough. Like that he would be able to absorb what's being said.
Gosh.
And what's so fucked up is, so this question, you know, it comes from the New York Times and they've been doing it for a long time. They used to do it when it was Barack Obama and yeah. the answers would be like incredible. And now it's like,
I know.
It's like the ABC book. I'm like, well, let's pretend like no, you could actually yeah. teach him of something, course, you know, course. Or like a lot of people say the Constitution, which, yeah, that would be nice, but, you know, it's not really a book.
It's not a book. Yeah. You know, I would love, what is the name of that book? It's the book that Dr. King, one of the books that he wrote. And it's not the letter. It's not.
The autobiography of Martin Luther King.
No.
Where do we go from here?
Where do we go from here? This is the book. Where do we go from here? I honestly think this is the book that I think it's so revolutionary and it's rich with compassion because it's Dr. King, but it's also, it's revolutionary.
And yeah.
And it's about like, it just as the title suggests, where do we go from here? Like, what do we do now? You know, and it's a charge to humanity. It's a charge to the government. It's a charge to America. You know, my best friend, his name's Aaron. I'm going to give him a shout out because I just love him so much.
I love shout outs.
Yeah, his name's Aaron. Aaron Holmes, my guy. I've been friends with 30 years. Hmm. And I mean, like friend, 30 years. And he says, you know, the issue with America at its current state is that we have conflated the American dream with the American ideal.
Hmm.
And what he argues is that the American dream is a fallacy, but the American ideal is masterful.
Hmm.
And what we've actually fallen short of is the American ideal, right? What it was supposed to, what the ideas around this country were meant to be.
Right.
Because we've been sort of bamboozled into believing in some American dream. But American dream could never be if the country was not only built on slavery, but built by rich people.
Right. Well, and maybe the American dream to me has always felt like a personal.
It is.
As opposed to the ideal feels like a collective.
It's communal.
Yeah. You know,
like what
was the point?
What was the point? Right. But that the flaw wasn't, it's interesting because what Aaron argues that the flaw, the original sin wasn't slavery. It was wealthy white men, right? Sort of controlling what democracy actually was supposed to. It was flawed from the jump.
Right.
But because that democracy never actually existed, because had they given slaves the option to not be slaves, they would have opted out.
Right.
But they weren't given the option, which means democracy was never a thing.
Right.
Right. Because it was controlled by, price is a very different thing.
Like processing.
Right. It's interesting. Right. And so that book, Where Do We Go From Here? I think would be the one. Cause it really gets into that and about like, you know, what do we do now?
Mm.
You know, and I think that Donald Trump, it's hard, right? Because my job is to humanize the vilified.
Right.
It's just hard to do it in this particular state because I don't believe that he's moving ignorantly. I believe he's moving. I believe he's moving with intention. And that's what's frightening. And I don't try to pull empathy from people with the truth of the matter is that I'm definitely not interested in your sympathy. And I'd like to believe that you still have empathetic bones in your body. I'm not sure that you do, but I do believe that a book like this is something that I at least can sit on your conscience. It may not change anything, but
right.
I still would want you to even just to do the due diligence and to have to sit down and dedicate time to reading something about something other than yourself.
Right.
And to see your place in that continuum as a roadblock could be just a powerful experience.
Yeah. That's so good. When is Aaron Holmes's book coming out?
He actually is working on.
Oh, okay.
He's working on. He's doing what they used to do back in the day when they would write, you know, those like short pamphlets. He believes the next wave for political and social intake through media will be a return to the 30-page pamphlet.
All right, like the Reynolds paper.
There you go.
Well, not even.
Right.
I didn't even mean you, but yeah.
No, but like the newspaper.
But I saw Hamilton, so I know all about it. All right, Jason, this was awesome. You're going to be back next week. Everyone, go out and get his newest book, Look Both Ways. But, you know, I guess any of his books you could go get. They're all out there in the world right now. Mm. Stamped, coming out in March.
And next week, we're going to be talking about Red at the Bone by Jacqueline Woodson. There will be some spoilers, so please read the book before you come back to listen. Also, if you haven't read Look Both Ways, we're going to talk about that more next week also. So if you want to pick it up, it'll take you, what, a day maybe, max?
Oh, yeah.
It's amazing. A couple hours. Yeah, it'll take you a few hours. Actually, pretty much all of Jacqueline Woodson's and Jason's book. So you'll be fine. But there will probably be a little bit of spoilering happening next week. So Jason, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I'm so sorry.
he's already picked up the chat. He's already moving on. And we will see you guys in the stacks. Thank you so much to Jason for being my guest today. And thank you all so much for listening. I'd also like to say thank you to Candace for helping set up this interview and the folks over at Simon Kids for sending over a copy of Look Both Ways. You can find everything we discussed on today's episode in the link in the show notes. Make sure to get your book recommendation read on air by sending us an email at askingthestacks@gmail.com. For more from The Stacks, please follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, The Stacks Podcast. To join the Stacks Pack and get inside access to this show, head to patreon.com/thestacks. Thanks to Audible, listeners of this podcast get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download by going to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Make sure you are subscribed to this show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review the show. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegeerigis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.